The Blessed Goddess said, Nop. Not. Yasha. Of whom? Loke. In the material world. Aste. Is. Atishayanaha. Having no rival. Priyaha. Dear. Tata. So. Apriyaha. Enemy. Deyabritam. Bearing material bodies. Priyatmanaha. Who is the most beloved? Tasmin. Towards Lord Shiva. Samasta Atmani. The universal being. Mukta Vairake. Who is free from all enmity. Rite. Except. Bhavantam. For you. Katamaha. Who. Pratipayat. Would be envious. Translation. The Blessed Goddess said, Lord Shiva is the most beloved of all living entities. He has no rival. No one is very dear to him. And no one is his enemy. No one but you could be envious of such a universal being who is free from all enmity. You can repeat. The Blessed Goddess said, Lord Shiva is the most beloved of all living entities. He has no rival. No one is very dear to him. And no one is his enemy. No one but you could be envious of such a universal being who is free from all enmity. So purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada, Ki Jai. In Bhagavad Gita 9th chapter, text 29, the Lord says, Samaham Sarva Bhuteshu. I am equal to all living entities. Similarly, Lord Shiva is a qualitative incarnation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So he has almost the same quality, sir, as the Supreme Lord. Therefore, he is equal to everyone. No one is his enemy and no one is his friend. But one who is envious by nature can become the enemy of Lord Shiva. Therefore, Sati accused her father, no one but you could be envious of Lord Shiva or be his enemy. Other sages and learned brahmanas were present, but they were not envious of Lord Shiva, although they were all dependent on Daksha. Therefore, no one but Daksha could be envious of Lord Shiva. That was the accusation of Sati. So, Devi Vacha, the Yashalokist, Yati Shayana Priyas, Tatap Priyo Deha Britam Priyatmana, Tasmin Samastat Mani Muktavairake, Rite Bhavantam Katama Pratipayet. So, Omagana Timiranda Shah, Gananjana Shlake, Achakshurun Meditam, Yena Tasmai, Shigurave Namaha. So, we have to ask the question, why is Lord Shiva the most beloved? It's the first statement here in the translation. Why is he the most beloved of all living entities? And in other words, why does he love all living entities? And why do all living entities love him, or should love him, that is? We can understand this in terms of the statement in the Isa Upanishad, Yastu Sarvani Atmani, that he sees all living entities equally. Yastu sarvani bhutani atman evana pashyati sarvabhuteshu tatman chatmanam tatona vigupshate, because he sees everyone equal with equal quality. But why specifically does he see everyone with equal quality? Because basically he is our father. And we're all his children, whether you like it or not. Just like Krishna says in the Gita, in one sense. Just like Krishna says in the Gita, Ham Bija Prada Pitaha. I am the seed-giving father, Bija. Bija means seed. I am the seed-giving father of everyone, which is a very interesting statement, Aham Bija Padapita, because at the same time we hear the statement, Nicho Nichanam Chaitanas Chaitanam Eko Bahunam Yobadadati Kama, which means we're eternal. So, you know, in reality, you know, no one's our father because you're eternal. You know, we're co-eternals with Krishna, right? Krishna is eternal. We're eternal. Of course, he does something that we like, which is providing the needs for the plural eternal entities, which is us. You know, we're dependent on him. So how can Krishna say he's the seed-giving father, Aham Bija Pradapita, when actually we're co-eternal? Because this verse in Gita, which is very interesting, refers to his interactions with the material energy in the form of Lord Shiva. Because in that way, he's the seed-giving father. In other words, just to explain things more explicitly, when Krishna, in the form of the Mahavishnu, breathed out, I thought it was something funny. Anyway, material world comes out, we can say that's his bad breath. But anyway, this is funny, I couldn't resist. You understand? That's one quarter of the Lord's creation. It's covered by darkness. The rest of the Lord's creation is light, brilliant, happiness. So in one sense, we can say that's the Lord's bad breath. Anyway. Just a little joke, humor for you. So when he breathes out, the universes come out from him in seed-like form, but those universes are inert. Just like you have substances in this world that are inert. Inert means they just don't do anything. If something is inert, for example, let's say you try to think of it. Oh, yeah. Helium is inert. You understand helium? Because, you know, it floats, I understand, but it's not going to explode or anything. Whereas hydrogen is not inert. Because hydrogen, anyway, if you have a blimp, and the blimp has hydrogen in it, it's called the Hindenburg. Anyone's heard of the Hindenburg? The Hindenburg, you know, hit some tower or something like that and exploded, and all the people died. So it's not inert. So inert gas is something that doesn't do anything. You know, not dangerous, inert. So helium is an inert gas. So anyway, so the material energy is inert, which means it's just there. There's nothing going on. It's just the pradhana, the unmanifest stage of the material energy, unmanifest stage of the modes of material nature. So then at the time of the creation, Krishna looks at this material creation. He just looks, because Krishna Angani Yasha Shakalan Driyadri Timanti. Krishna can do anything with any of his senses that he wants, which is pretty cool. And he looks, and it's just like the glance by which all of us become implanted in the material creation. You know, we're actually, it's quite interesting, just like sometimes you see these movies where someone has X-ray eyes or something like that. I don't know if Gopal's watching. But, you know, like Superman, for example, he could look and there was like, you know, he can actually burn people with his vision. I don't know if he's watching. We're not going to look at the chat. Don't look at the chat. So anyway, so in the same way, Krishna, like things come out of his eyes. Huh? And that's us. And Lord Shiva. Actually, Lord Shiva comes out, and Lord Shiva has all of us within him, just like a man. In the seminal fluid, there are all the jiva souls floating. You understand? And Prabhupada, Pumsa Reta Kanashaya is the statement in Sanskrit, that are implanted in the womb of the lady. You know, the jiva souls are actually these little spermatozoas. And anyway, so Lord Shiva's body is something like that. So Krishna looks at the material creation. Lord Shiva's there. We're within Lord Shiva. And Lord Shiva implants us within the womb of Maya. That's pretty cool, isn't it? And so he's Daddy Shiva. Think about it. So in that sense, Krishna is the seed-giving father because his expansion is Lord Shiva. Of course, Lord Shiva comes in contact with the material energy. He's not exactly the same as Krishna. And the example given, and we all know this, the example given in the Brahma Sangita, it's like the yogurt. When it comes in contact with the little yogis or some acidic thing, then the milk turns to yogurt, right? So, you can't turn back, but it's pretty much the same thing as milk, but it has different qualities than milk. So that's Lord Shiva. So he's actually our father. So being our father, he loves us all. I mean, just like a father, a real father, good father, sacrifice. I remember how my father would sacrifice, and I didn't really appreciate him. Some sentiment here. So I went to the university, and, I just asked for a sports car. My father got me a sports car, an MG Midget. I don't know if you know what an MG Midget is. And, I said, Dad, can I have more money? So he sent me money. I didn't even think about where the money came from, how he had to work hard, or anything like that. I just thought, it's his responsibility. He's supposed to give me something. He's supposed to pay for me, And this way, I was enjoying life before he came to the Krishna Consciousness Movement. No, I didn't enjoy life. But anyway, I enjoyed when I came to the Krishna Consciousness Movement. But anyway, so I was dependent upon my father. It was just a natural relationship. And he was, I guess he was happy to do it. I didn't ask him. I wasn't at least bit empathic or sensitive in those days. I just thought, he's supposed to do it. That's his duty. And I'm supposed to enjoy. I'm his son. That's my duty. Anyway, I don't know. Anyway, when people are young, they can't really appreciate what they're getting from their parents. And he worked real hard, day duty, night duty, anything I wanted, I got. So Lord Shiva is something like that. Not that he has to work a job, open up a cleaning plant like my father, but but he's concerned about us, and so much concern that he's self-sacrificing for us, just like our father was self-sacrificing. I mean, an example of that, I was thinking a wonderful example of Lord Shiva's self-sacrificing mood towards us. There's many examples, but one example comes to mind is once upon a time, there were the demons. Let's not use the word demon. Those who were challenged in their religious understanding. Those who have some needs to be met, Anyway, they were demons. So, I mean, some of them were good guys. Some demons actually worship Krishna. It's not... actually, it's stated in Bhagavatam, the demons and the devotees worship the Lord. So, anyway, the demons and the demigods, they wanted to churn the ocean of milk. And in order to churn the ocean of milk, there were several things required. Of course, we know they had to use Vasuki, the serpent, as the churning, rope. And Mount Mandara is the churning rod. And anyway, there's so many stories in the Bhagavatam about that, how the Lord had to sit on the top so the whole thing wouldn't topple over. And then the Lord had to be on the bottom to be the pivot because he wanted to have his back scratched as Lord Kurma. So anyway, the demons... it's interesting. The demons actually were given the choice what part of the serpent you want to hold. And they said, the auspicious part is the mouth. But they didn't realize with a serpent, the inauspicious part is the mouth because the serpents have bad breath. I've never met a serpent with good breath yet. So, anyway, even when I was young, I would put, not in serpents, but I would put Listerine in my dog's mouth so it wouldn't have bad breath. So they were, the demons, they grabbed the head. And they became nauseous. from grabbing the head because the head had bad breath, you know, fiery breath or something like that. And the demigods were fortunate enough to have the tail. So they were churning, churning, churning. So many things came out of this ocean of milk. I mean, a lot of things like Lakshmi came out, Dhanvantari came out. But as far as this particular story is concerned, is this poison, was it Kaladuta or something like that, came out, this like horrendous poison that was threatening to kill all the living entities, came out of this ocean of milk. And, you know, nobody knew what to do. And then along comes Lord Shiva to the rescue. And what does he do? He drinks it all. I mean, that's a sacrifice. I mean, of course, he's capable of drinking it all. Like Prabhupada oftentimes gives the example that no one should try to imitate Lord Shiva unless he's capable of drinking an ocean of poison. Prabhupada said that in regard to people who smoke ganja. He said people who smoke ganja, they say they were worshippers of Lord Shiva, but actually we should not imitate. There's Anukar, Adusar, we should follow the footsteps but not imitate the great personalities. So anyway, so Lord Shiva drank this, and as a result, his throat turned blue. You know, that's a real sacrifice. Having your throat turn blue the rest of your life, you got to live with a blue throat because you saved somebody. But that's the affection. And of course, anyway, we'll talk about that in a second. But some of the little animals, like these little spiders, the poisonous spiders and the snakes, they actually got the remnants of Lord Shiva. You know, whatever he couldn't get, you know, a few drops fell out and they took it. And that's why they're so poisonous. I mean, there's snakes that are so poisonous that if they look at you, you die. Seriously. Like, when Hanuman was going to the Himalayas, when they were fighting this Mahiravana, he had to go to the Himalayas and get something. And anyway, and then there were snakes guarding it, these ferocious snakes, and even if they looked at you, you would die. So he had to blow some dust in their faces so they couldn't look at him. And then he ate them. But anyway, and of course, Kaliya serpent, you know, he was really poisonous. He was so poisonous that any of the cows who actually came near the Jamuna, anyone who breathed the air, any bird who flew over the Jamuna River at that point, he would die immediately. Isn't it? They were just like, you know, some poor bird was flying over right into the Jamuna River because he was so poisonous and his breath was horrible. And Krishna danced on his head. That shows how merciful Krishna is. Anyway, so that's how poisonous the poison was. So anyway, so Lord Shiva drank it, his throat turned blue, and that was out of compassion for us. Isn't that nice? You know, because Lord Shiva loves us so much. You know, Lord Shiva actually loves us. And of course that love, just like a father's love sometimes becomes a little sentimental, right? Like my father's love for me became sentimental. He would get me anything I wanted, you know, sports cars and everything like that. And it didn't always think of, you know, is this good for the guy or is this not good for the guy, right? So Lord Shiva's love sometimes becomes sentimental. I mean, that's out of love. Actually, Prabhupada said in the Bhagavad Gita, talking about Arjuna's sentimental love for his family members and his guru, he said this is a sign of devotion, that one has become soft-hearted like that. So sometimes you see devotees, it's not necessarily a bad thing, that sometimes devotees become real sentimental. That's because they're soft-hearted. It's interesting. I mean, I was reading something the other day where about military discipline. You know, Prabhupada said we should have military discipline in the Krishna conscious movement. And, you know, there's some discussion like in the sociological sense about military discipline, whether you should just like, ours is not to question why, ours is but to what? Do or die. So, but at the same time, Prabhupada said, blind following and absurd inquiries are to be condemned. So you have these two things juxtaposed, you know, military discipline and blind following. So my understanding is, yes, the military discipline the Prabhupada is referring to is the proper etiquette and respect and everything like that. But not that one doesn't have the right to inquire from the spiritual master, you know, and, you know, if there's some question, or one doesn't have the, you know, one or one shouldn't take things out of context. You know, like we were talking about the other day, like Prabhupada said, you know, if someone said, a mundane scientist or impersonalist, you kick on his face with boots. So I don't want anyone going to the university, you know. You know, University of North Carolina, and you get the boots, the golf shoes, you know, with the spikes in it and everything like that. And just start kicking on people's faces. You know, it's not that Prabhupada literally wanted that. So one has to really, you know, Prabhupada is much more philosophical than any military commander in the war. You have to really understand things in the proper context, inquire, take association from the devotees. I mean, it's a little bit more complex than, you know, onward, onward into the valley of death, march the 500 or something like that. Isn't it? A lot more complex than that. And so anyway, getting back to the point is, Lord Shiva gets a little sentimental sometimes. And like Arjuna, he was sentimental in the Bhagavad Gita. And Krishna said, this is a sign of soft-heartedness. Although Krishna didn't agree with his soft-heartedness. But it's not necessarily a bad thing to be soft-hearted. But then you should be ready to take instructions from Krishna to see if your soft-heartedness is appropriate. So Lord Shiva, he gets really soft-hearted sometimes and gives benedictions that will even threaten his own position. I mean, like that story of Vikasura, where this demon was doing a sacrifice with pieces of flesh. I mean, I couldn't imagine doing that. Could you imagine, like, tearing off pieces of flesh from your own body? Yuck. Yuck. I mean, ooh, just like even if I'm cutting some vegetables and I nick myself or something like that, isn't it? A pervert, sometimes I'm sure you nick yourself or cut yourself when you're cutting vegetables, right? It's not like, ooh, and then you wash yourself off, put some, like, cactus, you know, stuff on your finger, you know, put some Band-Aid, like that. So imagine cutting your flesh off and just offering. That's a real demon. You have to be really determined, too. I wish I was so determined. Anyway, not to do that, but, I mean, be Krishna conscious. I mean, you know, we can't even hear nicely the holy names. Think about, juxtapose that demon's determination to our determination. We can't even keep our mind steady from one Hare Krishna mantra. What to speak of, you know, tearing off our flesh. How determined are we? Utsahan nischaya daryat. I mean, we're really challenged in that respect. And so, anyway, so he was tearing off his flesh. Not so fast. Anyway, swaha. Maybe he wasn't saying swaha. He was saying shivaya namaha. He wasn't saying swaha. He was saying shivaya namaha. Shivaya namaha. Shivaya namaha. And finally, you know, basically the whole body was raw. You know, where am I going to tear my flesh off from now, you know? I guess he had taken parts of his face off and everything like that, you know, what's left? And he thought, well, the head, you know, let me just cut off my whole head. So he took a bath, getting ready to, because before you offer an animal in sacrifice, you're supposed to bathe it. That's information you should all be aware of. So anyway, so he got ready to cut his head off, and Lord Shiva said, nah, come on. I'm satisfied, you know, with very, very little. Like, Lord Shiva's Ashutosh. That's another sign of sentimentality. Ashutosh. Ashutosh means easily pleased, easily angered. That, if a person's sentimental, they're like that. You know, they're easily pleased and easily. All you got to do is say, oh, you're so nice. And they go, oh, I love you. You know, I wish it was so easy with everybody. Wish everyone was sentimental. It'd be easy to make devotees. Anyway, so like a man says to a woman, oh, you have such eyes, beautiful eyes. The women are more sentimental than men. You can't do that to men. Like if I said to Mahamantra, you have beautiful eyes, you go, huh? Where's he coming from? You know, like... So people who are sentimental can actually be influenced a lot easier than people who are not sentimental. It's interesting. You can, of course, they swing from one side to the other real quickly, too. From happiness to distress, from crying to ecstasy, from blessing you to cursing you. It's really cool. No, it's not. So anyway... That's why, anyway, I don't know if I should say. But anyway, so that's why, you know, people married sometimes, they get home and they don't know what they're going to be dealing with when they get home. Is she in a bad mood or a good mood today? You know, it's just like, I'm home. You know, are you here? But usually, you know, women are more sentimental than men. But anyway, sometimes it's the opposite. You know, we had one person who complained that his mother's not sentimental and his father is. So, you know, in Kali Yuga, it sort of gets reversed a little bit sometimes. Anyway, so Lord Shiva is like that. You know, it's a sign of devotion, a sign of soft-heartedness. And so he just gave this demon the benediction that, the demon asked for the benediction. You know, I want the benediction. Whoever's head I touch will split into like 1,000 or 1,000,000 pieces. Lord Shiva didn't even think about it. Oh, yeah. I'm just concerned. I don't want him tearing his flesh anymore, you know. Because what was Lord Shiva's consciousness? He was actually being compassionate. This poor son of mine is tearing his flesh and doing all these things. You know, just here, take the benediction. Don't tear your flesh anymore. You don't have to offer your hand, you know, I'm easily pleased. And so this demon, or a person who was challenged, he actually went running after a person with certain needs that needed to be ascertained. Anyway, so he went running after Lord Shiva to take Parvati. You know, he wanted to kill Lord Shiva, take Parvati. And finally, I'm not going to tell the story, but he was saved by Lord Vishnu, who tricked him, you know, he said, Lord Vishnu wasn't so sentimental. He was more strategic. He was thinking, you know, how can we trick this demon? You know, he was... Anyway, sometimes there's a need for diagnosis. For labeling. He's a demon. Demons are lazy, generally. He was thinking like that, Lord Vishnu. So let me use this demoniac propensity against him. It's called judo. And then he said to this demon, he said, look, why are you tiring yourself out? You know, every time your heart beats, your life is being, lifespan is being diminished. He used a little philosophy on him. I said, and you're running, your heart is beating fast. What do you used to talk about that all the time? We shouldn't jog, because if you jog, your heart beats fast, and you're going to die sooner. Because you have a limited number of heartbeats. You know, like when you're born, it's like an hourglass, and the sand is gradually trickling away. So, anyway, so he used that particular argument on the demon. You know, why? Save time, Prabhu. And touch your own head and test this benediction first. And if it works, great, then continue running after Lord Shiva. And if it doesn't work, then you have right to be angry with Lord Shiva. So he tried it, and it worked. So anyway, so Lord Shiva actually was a little bit too sentimental. Of course, it's the Lord's pastime. I understand that. But it was his kind-heartedness. And he's so kind-hearted that we find demons... We still got 4 more minutes. We find demons and devotees both worship him, which is interesting. Demons and devotees. And even, you know, we find the Lord sometimes worshiping him, like Lord Ramchandra. He worshipped Lord Shiva when he was attempting to cross over the ocean to Sri Lanka. He made the Shiva Linga there, worshipped Lord Shiva, as just an example for us. And then also you find that Arjuna, he was worshiping Lord Shiva. So you find so many, and Lord Shiva has so many expansions that are devotees like Hanuman. And then you have demons. So it's really interesting. I mean, that Lord Shiva is beloved by all. This is the point here. So anyway, so we here we find that Daksha is envious of Lord Shiva. Actually, he's not really envious of Lord Shiva. He's envious of himself. That's the real point. That he actually... He's actually envious of himself. He doesn't understand who Lord Shiva is. If he understood who Lord Shiva was, he wouldn't be envious of him. So Daksha being envious of himself, or actually projecting the image he had, this is called projection, of Lord Shiva, not seeing the real Lord Shiva, then he exhibited these symptoms, and one of the symptoms was criticizing Lord Shiva. And, as Prabhupada mentions here, even though the other brahmanas present and sages present there were not envious of Lord Shiva, they backed up Daksha because they were being maintained by him. This is another important point. It's just, Prabhupada hints at it in his purport. He says, other sages and learned brahmanas are present, but they were not envious of Lord Shiva, although they were all dependent on Daksha. So what does that mean? That means if one really wants to be brahminical, one should not be dependent upon someone who is materialistic. Because if you're dependent upon someone who's materialistic, you cannot exhibit brahminical qualities or be brahminical. You can be dependent on someone who's spiritual, like your spiritual master, or Krishna, personalities like that. But be dependent on someone who has some material tendencies, then your brahminical status becomes lost. And as we see here, the brahmanas, some of the brahmanas, not only lost their brahminical status later on, but they lost some other things too. So any questions or comments about these points? Arguments? Yeah, Apurva.
I don't understand how Daksha can be envious of himself.
Because what he's doing, actually this is stated by, let me explain this. This is explained, it's stated by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. I'm finding faults in others because I myself am pockmarked by those same faults. So he's projecting his own understanding and his own inadequacies upon the screen of Lord Shiva. And of course, he also wants what Lord Shiva has. He wants the respect that Lord Shiva has. You know, Daksha's thinking, you know, I worked so hard. So it's not really Lord Shiva's envious of, in any case. It's that he wants something. You know, he's thinking, I worked so hard to be this Daksha, you know, Prajapati. And Lord Shiva, you know, he's not working hard at all. Look at me, I'm dressed up nicely, you know, put on the finest clothes, and Lord Shiva, you know, is practically naked. You know, and he gets all the respect. I mean, just like sometimes we may see... Oh yeah, recently there was one lady who won the contest for being the best singer in the world or best singer in Great Britain, and she's ugly. I don't know if you saw that in the news, did you?
Yeah.
What's her name?
Susan Boyle.
And so the other ladies are looking at that and thinking, you know, I'm much more attractive than her. Huh? I'm not overweight. You know, my face, they look in the mirror. I'm sure it's happening with the ladies. They look in the mirror. Huh? Like that. So it's not really envious of her. They're it's their own characteristics that they're actually dealing with. They're projecting their desires. They're projecting their understanding. They're projecting their own faults upon the screen of the other person. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur says, I'm finding fault in you because I myself am pockmarked with those same faults. So that's generally a fault-finding thing like that. So it's because you don't know the other person. How can you act in, you know, I know we say in common parlance we're envious of someone else, but you can't even know the other person. All we see is the body. Just like I can say, you know, I'm envious of Mahamantra. But, do I know who he is? What's happening inside his brain or inside his soul or what his soul is like? I mean, I don't. Someone who's a material consciousness never even sees anyone else. So how can they be envious of someone else? And we can take that the other way. When someone starts to criticize us, and instead of saying they're envious of me, we can say they don't know me. How do they know me? Nobody knows me except for Krishna, maybe my spiritual master. But you know, who knows me? So they're just projecting their own understanding. So then, and that's an extension of themselves. Anyway, some ways to understand this. So all glory. Anyway, in common language, we do say we're envious. Someone's envious of someone else. But if we examine it, it's not exactly like that. We're dealing with our own. Jai, all glories to Srila Prabhupada. Just got to go looking on that. Jai.